books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
In association with RNIB Talking Books, this is Read On, the audiobook show. I'm your host, Robert Kirkwood, and on today's show, we enter the world of DC Fionn Morgan and DS Leo Bradley with author Claire McIntosh. Plus, we'll find some brand new books in the RNIB library. All that on today's Read On. Best-selling author of I Let You Go, Claire McIntosh, joined me around the release of Other People's Houses, her latest book in the DS Leo Bradley and DC Fionn Morgan series. We'll talk about that book later on, but first we spoke about the first two books in the series, and also touch on the books I Let You Go and our non-fiction book I Promise It Won't Always Hurt Like This. But for now, book three in the series, Other People's Houses, is narrated by Chloe and Harrod Davies.
The weather broke overnight, rain drumming onto baked earth and swirling along the pavements. There were few awake to see it, and by the morning, summer was restored. Now the sun is hot and high, despite the early hour. Water has drained into gutters and soaked into the cracked earth, and all that's left of the night's sudden storm is a welcome freshness in the air and the swollen banks of the Yauen. The river tumbles over itself in its effort to reach the lake, rushing over rocks and tree roots in a torrent of white foam. Every now and then, the force of the water dislodges a stick or a handful of moss from the bank and whips it downstream too fast for the eye to follow. 15-year-old Ed Clough is walking along the southern bank, away from the rafting centre. He has been sent to look for a missing kayak, and he is taking his time over it. Ed is supposed to be on kitchen duties this morning, but he spent yesterday evening at a young farmer's rally, and the thought of greasy bacon pans is making his stomach churn. He draws deep lungfuls of clean air and wonders how long he can string out his search. Most of the rafts and canoes are locked in a secure unit at night, but there are a few old yellow kayaks on a rack at the back of the centre, and they occasionally go missing. They are carried aloft by drunk stags and abandoned in the road once enough fun's been had, or they're launched into the river by bored kids. Before Ed started working at the rafting centre, he'd once done exactly that with his best mate, the two of them sprinting down the banks to try and beat the empty vessel to the lake. They'd lost by a country mile, as they'd known they would. White water won't be beaten.
Chloe and Harrod Davies reading from Other People's Houses by my guest, Claire McIntosh. We'll get to that book later on, but first I ask Claire where it all began for Brady and Morgan.
We meet Fionn and Leo at the start of the last party, and we actually meet them when they've spent the night together. They had a one-night stand. And we meet them when Fionn is sneaking out of Leo's bedroom thinking, I'm never going to see this guy again, except that a few hours later, they discover they are both police officers and both assigned to the same case. So that's the start of their relationship. They settle into a working relationship and agree to put all that behind them. And we've now followed them for three books. They're very different people. Fionn is a Welsh-speaking detective from North Wales, and Leo is her counterpart over in Cheshire. He is the city boy. He's the organised, rule follower, methodical, very polite, very sort of sensible. And Fionn is a bit of a maverick. She is often torn between what she should do and what she wants to do, and torn between the sort of rules and regulations of her job and the community in which she lives and works.
The first of two klaxons rings through the crisp air and a cheer goes up.
Ready? As I'll ever be.
Coats and robes are cast aside, towels draped over waiting arms and hot water bottles readied for the return. There's a rush for the shore, a tangle of white limbs and bathing suits, brave bikinis and judicious woolly hats, and excited chatter so loud they wonder as if they might miss the second klaxon. But when it sounds, there's no mistaking it, and they let out a whoop and a "Bloy the Noether!" as they run towards the lake, screaming as they reach the icy water. When they're deep enough, they plunge, mind over matter through the low-lying mist, cold clamps of vice around their chests, mouths opening in shock as their breath is wrenched away. "Keep moving! Keep moving!" cry the veterans, dopamine pumping smiles to their faces. Ripples become waves, the movement of people this way and that as the wind picks up and sends shivers across shoulders. As the mist begins to clear, a woman cries out. It stands out among the screams of excitement, sending shivers of a different kind down the backs of those waiting on the shore. Those still in their depth stand on tiptoes, straining to see what's happening. Who's hurt? The rescue boat dips its oars into the water, in and out, making its way towards the commotion. Out of the mist floats a man, face down, and quite unmistakably dead.
Now, the last party started with a trip to the lake, and your crime writer's mind imagined a body floating across it.
This is the thing about being I think any kind of writer is that we are constantly seeing stories, picking up characters, living a fantasy world in our heads, I suppose. And so you and I could be, you know, walking through a wood together, and you might be thinking about the leaves crunching underfoot and imagining how sort of atmospheric it is, how beautiful it is. And I would be potentially thinking about whether I could bury a body here and how long before it would be discovered. And on this particular occasion, it was New Year's Day, and I was about to go into the lake for our traditional New Year's Day swim. And everyone around me was talking about this mirror flat lake and the mountains reflected in it and how lucky we were and how beautiful it was. And it was beautiful, but all I could see in my head was a body floating through this very still freezing water and the resulting chaos as everyone on the shore and you know, getting into the water saw it too. And it just felt like the start of a novel. And so I went home and started thinking about it. And while that was going on, we went into lockdown. So the pandemic hit. I'd had this sort of vision in January 2020. And then by the end of February, I guess, we were in lockdown, and borders became really important. And the border between England and Wales became really significant because we, in Wales, we have devolved health authorities. And so we had different laws. You know, you could go out in England and you couldn't in Wales, or vice versa. You couldn't cross the border. And so suddenly we had this sort of hard border where we hadn't before. Now, I didn't want to write about the pandemic, but I did want to explore this divide, and a divide not just between England and Wales, but between different types of people, between rich people and not so rich people, between educated people and not so educated. So just the divides that we see and we create in society.
The lake in the book is called Mirror Lake, and reflection is important in that first story. Just not just a mirror image, but seeing the other side of the mirror.
Yeah, it is. I suppose I was thinking about how when you look in a mirror, actually what you see isn't exactly the truth. You know, it can be slightly distorted by the glass, or damage on the glass, or reflection, the shadows that a light's casting. If you look into your reflection in water, it will be very different. Again, it will be distorted. And what we think we're presenting isn't necessarily what other people are seeing. And so I wanted to play around with all those sorts of things, which I did in lots of different ways. I did it with the story itself. I did it with sort of linguistically with the prose. And I did it with the structure of that book, because The Last Party is a book divided in two halves, and we've got a couple of different timelines. So we have Fionn and Leo's investigation running in sort of real time, so finding the body and then investigating it until the conclusion of the investigation. But running parallel with that, we've also got what happened in the past, and that timeline runs backwards and then forwards. And when we move forwards in the second half of the book, we see all the same scenes that we saw in the first half. So a reflection of those scenes, but from someone else's perspective. And so what we thought we were seeing in the first half of the book is actually very different.
How was that to write? Because it seems pretty complicated. I'm imagining a cork board with pieces of string and notes all over it.
I mean, it's not far off that. I was a police officer for 12 years, and so I take a very analytical approach, I suppose, to my plotting. It was a nightmare, actually. It was really, really hard. And I made lots of revisions. And of course, every time I made a change to one scene, there was a mirror image scene that had to be altered. Yeah, it was a very difficult book to write. But I loved it because I was very passionate about the mystery that I was creating and about the characters. I really love Fionn and Leo. They're very real to me. I know they're very real to lots of readers. And I was really enjoying writing a slightly different kind of book, because I had mostly written psychological thrillers up until that point. And The Last Party and the next two books in the series are more, they're detective stories, I suppose. And The Last Party in particular is very, it sort of has echoes of those classic Agatha Christie style mysteries, where you have a cast of suspects and lots of different motives and opportunity, and the reader gets to solve this crime along with the detective. And that was really fun to do.
Did their chemistry come out through the writing, or did you always picture them as this kind of odd couple?
No, I didn't really know what their relationship was. After I had this body in the lake, I started thinking about who would be investigating it. And that's when this issue of borders came in. So I knew that I was going to have a Welsh detective and an English one. Fionn came first and pretty much arrived fully formed, both in terms of physical appearance. She has this sort of wild, untamable red hair, but also in terms of her personality. And then I knew that Leo was going to be pretty much opposite. And so I started to bring him to life. But I didn't know what their chemistry would be like. And I didn't know what their relationship would be like. I knew that this opening scene of the meeting would be quite fun, and I would just see what happened. And actually what happened fairly soon is that they agreed that their relationship would be pretty much strictly business. Now, we as the reader or listener, we start to understand that actually there is a spark there that they either don't see or are ignoring for quite a lot of that story. And so a lot of the suspense for us is how is that going to evolve, and are they going to acknowledge that chemistry?
Now, you mentioned distorted images, and the same thing can happen down the lens of a TV camera and in the edit suite. In book two, Game of Lies, we enter reality TV.
Yes, during the pandemic again, so this would have been sort of later that year or perhaps the following year, the producers of I Am a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here, which is normally filmed in the Australian outback, moved it to North Wales, to a castle not far from where I live. And I was just fascinated by the idea of all these celebrities being dropped into this incredibly ordinary place. I mean, a beautiful place, don't get me wrong. North Wales is very special for lots of reasons, but we're not used to having lots of celebrities here. And I thought that would be an interesting place to set a crime novel. There's also a lot of opportunity for backstabbing. You know, these celebrities, they all want to win something. And so I started thinking about what kind of reality TV show I might have. I decided that I didn't want celebrities. I wanted ordinary people. And I wanted them all to have an incredibly important reason for winning. So there is a prize at stake. And in fact, the conceit of A Game of Lies is that these contestants think they've signed up for a survival style show. So they think they're going to be making shelters and building fires and maybe jumping off cliffs, those sorts of things. But when the cameras start rolling, the presenter hits them with a bombshell that that's not the show they're on. The show they're on is indeed called Exposure, but the exposure relates to a secret. Each of them has a secret which would, if revealed, destroy their lives. And to stay in the game, they need to protect their own secret and expose someone else's. So suddenly the stakes become incredibly high. And that, of course, gives us great potential for a thriller.
The smell is sour and sweet at the same time, like fruit left to rot. Fionn breathes through her mouth, but the stink's so bad she can almost taste it.
Was that you?
DC Alan Whittaker speaks without looking up from his paperwork. He's too vain to wear reading glasses, and deep grooves form at the corner of his eyes as he squints at the file.
No, it bloody well wasn't.
Fionn shuts down the witness statement she's been reading and opens Rightmove. She needs the calming influence only 5 minutes of property porn can bring.
Women aren't supposed to fart.
Alan looks across the bank of desks and raises his voice.
I bet Georgina doesn't.
Georgina shrugs back at him, pointing to the noise-cancelling headphones she wears over her dark, cropped hair.
Just a podcast, she always says, if anyone asks.
Fionn has long suspected that Georgina isn't listening to anything at all. The woman's quick enough to say yes to a panad when the kettle goes on, but is selective about what she wants to hear.
I couldn't be with a woman who farts, says Alan,
as though he had a choice in the matter. Alan's last foray into the dating world had resulted in a bank transfer to an untraceable account and a computer virus that emailed out the last 10 photos from Alan's camera roll, three of which had made Fionn want to bleach her eyes.
Chloe and Harry Davies reading from Game of Lies by Claire McIntosh. And we'll have more from Claire in a moment.
Thanks to the kind donations from many of UK's audio publishers, it can be hard to keep up with all the great new books entering the Talking Books Library. So here are two new gems.
The Man Who Cycled the World by Mark Beaumont was given to us by Penguin Random House.
After only 10 kilometres, I was exhausted. My legs were fresh, but my head dropped and my eyelids started slow blinking. The surge of adrenaline at the start had passed, and I felt shattered. The last few weeks had been a series of ridiculous and unsustainable routines that left me completely void of energy at the outset of my 18,000-mile cycle. By the time our small convoy, which was Mum, my elder sister, Heather, and a friend in a car, plus the motorbike escort to help me navigate the labyrinth that is central Paris, neared the Charles de Gaulle airport, I could hardly stay on the bike. This didn't feel like normal tiredness, but a deep, sleep-deprived exhaustion, the sort that leaves you feeling hollow. Waving goodbye to the escort, at the outskirts of Paris, a bit further on, I cycled as far as the next cafe. I had to stop. I had an espresso and a Coke, hoping the life would return to me. But all I wanted to do was sleep. I felt silly as the waiter expressed how impressed he was at what I was doing. It didn't feel very impressive. I was pale and felt completely washed out. This was the opportunity of my life, and here I was waiting for caffeine and sugar to help me back on the bike within miles of the start.
On the 15th of February 2008, Mark Beaumont pedalled through the Arc de Triomphe in Paris. 194 days and 17 hours previously, he'd begun his attempt to circumnavigate the world in record time. Mark smashed the Guinness World Record by an astonishing 81 days. He travelled more than 18,000 miles on his own through some of the harshest conditions one man and his bicycle can endure, camping wild at night and suffering from constant ailments. The man who cycled the world is the story not just of that amazing achievement, but of the events that turned Mark Beaumont into the man he is today. From the early years of his free-spirited childhood in the Scottish countryside to present day, he has been equally determined not to settle for an average existence, but to break free and follow his dreams.
The start had been a slightly confused affair. For Mum and others, it was emotional, but I felt somewhat removed. For so many months, all I'd wanted to do was be on the road. Now, finally at that point, there was no part of me that was sad or thinking about missing anyone, no part that was concerned about what lay ahead. The last day before leaving was hot and clear, but spent entirely in room 409 of the Radisson in Paris. Only in the evening did Heather, my mum, and I take time out for a send-off meal at Volant-Saint-Chaban, a charming wee restaurant near the Porte de Saint-Claude. It was Dad who said a few words and raised the toast. I've not always had the full support of Dad or seen eye to eye with him, but despite our differences, I was grateful for his acknowledgement of the task that lay ahead. We had laid things out, packed, unpacked, repacked, and sorted all day long. When laid out on the bed, the kit had seemed like a lot. Amazingly, after juggling items between the four main pannier bags to find the balance, it fitted well. It would have been easy to stay up all night faffing and fiddling, but by one in the morning I could do no more. The bike was ready and packed, and we were not being particularly productive with the remaining admin jobs. There was too much to do to feel terribly excited.
The Man Who Cycled the World by Mark Beaumont is narrated by the author and runs for 18 hours and 26 minutes.
The publisher W&N recently gave us There and Back, Diaries 1999 to 2009 by Michael Palin.
There have been signature years in my life which, like swollen rivers or windswept mountains, I've approached with wary respect. 1984 was one. George Orwell's book had fixed in my young mind a dark and sinister threat that seemed at one time awfully real. But all was well as the year dawned, free of menace. The other year that came with an association close to such significance is covered in these diaries. 2000 AD, not just my son's favourite comic, but a truly landmark year. The end of a millennium. Something that only happened every 1,000 years. William the Conqueror was not even born when humans last experienced a year like this. But my diary, on this epoch-shifting day, merely notes, I walk up to Southend Green for a paper.
A new millennium and a new chapter for Michael Palin unfolds. With a Hemingway travel project testing his confidence, doubts creeping in about his abilities as a writer, and the death of his great friend, George Harrison, and the last of his children leaving home, the dawn of the 21st century sees Michael at his most reflective yet. Over the next 10 years, we watch through Michael's eyes as the world reels from successive shocks of September 11, the 7/7 bombings, and the global financial crash. With the warmth and gentle empathy that have endeared him to millions of fans over the decades, Michael documents the day-to-day detail of living in a world buffeted by such powerful winds of change. Amidst this turbulence, one thing remains constant: Michael's irrepressible curiosity and thirst for adventure. These diaries follow his life as he comes and goes through the filming of four blockbuster travel documentaries, Hemingway Adventure, Sahara, Himalaya, and New Europe, and reaches the peak of his fame as a beloved TV traveller. And 5 years on from the last of his children flying the nest, Michael embarks on his greatest adventure yet, becoming a besotted grandfather. There and Back is a new window into the world of Michael Palin, one that reveals more than ever the strength and succour he draws from those constant supporting structures in his life, his family, his friendships, and of course, the pythons.
By far the most significant day in these diaries is not January the 1st, 2000, but September the 11th, 2001. On that day, I'm in a small Saharan town in the 144th poorest country in the world. The first thing I hear on my arrival in this remotest of places is that the Twin Towers in New York have been attacked and destroyed, with the loss of hundreds, possibly thousands of lives. Rereading my diaries around that dreadful event, I'm struck by descriptions not just of what happened on that world-changing day, but what it felt like on the day before and the day after. The great thing about a diary is that it is all about continuity, about time moving on. Few other literary forms exist to show what it's like to survive, how bad things can change with perspective, and good things too. There and Back is an account of an increasingly restless life, darting and dodging about the planet. But I never assumed that one journey would follow another, and these diaries show the squirming indecision between each one as I try to prioritise the rest of my life and do all the other things I want to do. Though I seem constantly on the move, there and back, most of my time is spent at home. Because for me, the real attraction of going to new places is the joy of coming home and realising the sheer satisfaction of looking at the world out of your own windows. Asked to write a snappy strapline for this new volume, I came up with There and Back, 11 years on and off the road as Michael tries to grow up. And there's not much I can add to that.
There and Back, Diaries 1999 to 2009 by Michael Palin, is narrated by Michael Palin and runs for 27 hours and 28 minutes.
For more information, head to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
RNIB Talking Books provides more than 1 million audiobooks every year to people with sight loss and is now completely free for all blind and partially sighted people in the UK. The RNIB Library is the largest of its kind in Europe and offers a wide range of fiction and non-fiction titles which readers can access on CD, on USB or as a digital download so that you can listen how you choose, whether at home or on the go. To find out more about the RNIB Library or to sign up for your free membership, call the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999 or visit www.rnib.org.uk/library.
Now, a return to my interview with Claire McIntosh. Other People's Houses is read by Chloe and Harrod Davies.
Just as Ed is about to turn around, he sees a glimmer of yellow through the trees. He brightens. Donna can't give him a row about how long he's been away from the kitchen if he finds the missing kayak. She might even let him off bacon duty. The vessel is upside down between rocks, stern pushed under water and bow in the air. Ed tugs at it, but it's hard to get a purchase on the resin hull. The bank is steep and slippery, and he grips a tree root with his left hand to stop himself from sliding into the water. He pushes his foot against the kayak, but it won't budge. Ed sighs. Then he kicks off his trainers and strips to his underpants. Donna better put something extra in his pay packet this month. This is above and beyond a minimum wage weekend job. Despite the heat wave, the river is freezing. Mud squelches beneath his toes. Something flits, tiny and fast, between his legs. Ed squeals involuntarily and immediately looks around, relieved to confirm there was no one to hear it. Waist deep, he reaches over the kayak to grab the opposite side of it so he can use his full force to yank it out from between the rocks and flip it back over. It's stuck fast, and Ed pulls and pulls, and suddenly it comes free. And now the kayak is right side up, and it's Ed who's upside down, thrown off balance and clinging on to the kayak as he flails for a footing. It's barely a second, although it feels like longer, before he resurfaces, cursing this stupid job, his stupid boss, the stupid kids who stole a kayak and let it float downriver to lodge itself in these rocks and... Ed stops thinking. He stops breathing. His entire body is trembling, goosebumps covering his skinny frame, from his ice-cold feet to the white-knuckled hand still gripping the kayak. The kayak that had been so hard to turn over, not only because it was trapped, but also because it was heavy. Because there was someone in it.
We're bringing it up to date now. The latest book in this series has just been released. Tell us about Other People's Houses.
Other People's Houses might just be my favourite of the three. It starts with another body. I've got bodies everywhere. starts with a body in an upturned kayak this time. And that's what Fionn is dealing with over in Wales. It's a body that is very quickly identified as belonging to an estate agent who was on a kind of an outward bound team building weekend in North Wales from an estate agency in Cheshire. So that's what Fionn's up to. Meanwhile, across the border in Cheshire, Leo is dealing with a series of high-value burglaries which are taking place in a street with the most exclusive postcode in Cheshire. So we've got huge, luxury, beautiful houses occupied by rich people behaving appallingly, which is one of my favourite type of characters to write. So Leo's dealing with that. And then we've also got another investigation happening in this novel. We've got a cold case, a 10-year-old double murder. Now, somehow these three cases are connected, but it's down to the reader to find out how.
Now, have you recently had experience with some estate agents that wasn't brilliant?
I mean, hasn't everyone got a story about an estate agent? I'm sure there are lots of lovely estate agents. It's more the process, isn't it? It's really exhausting buying and selling a house. And when we moved to Wales, we had our heart set on a house which fell through, and then another one, and we were gesumped on the day of exchange, which was a really awful, awful process. So yes, I suppose I'm sort of taking a little bit of revenge on the property business, shall we say, rather than estate agents specifically, but I did enjoy writing some unethical estate agents.
Now, even though these books are in a series, they're all standalones. You can enjoy each one for its own merits.
Yes, it was really important to me that you could read or listen to any of these books on their own and you wouldn't miss anything. So I sort of refer to them as linked books, I suppose, rather than... they're certainly not sequels. So there are definitely elements that if you've read from the beginning, you'll perhaps get a little bit more nuance. You'll certainly enjoy the developing relationship between Fionn and Leo a little bit more, I think, if you've read from the beginning. But you can pick up Other People's Houses and not miss anything from a plot point of view.
It's the kind of book where you're joining the dots as a reader and the picture is revealed. Do you know the picture at the start?
I do, yes, because I plot everything in extreme detail. That doesn't mean that it doesn't change, and Other People's Houses did evolve. In fact, the cold case investigation strand wasn't there initially. That came in draft 2 or maybe 3, I think. So things do change, but I pretty much know the twists, the turns, the villains from the start.
Now, as with another recent guest, you don't have to travel far for your research. You mentioned this. You were in the police force for 12 years. Tell us about your time on the force.
I loved my career as a police officer. I still miss it sometimes. I did lots of different things. I was a detective for a time. I worked as a custody inspector. I specialised latterly as a public order commander and operations inspector. So dealing with things like protests, demonstrations, football, hooliganism, that sort of thing. And I loved the feeling of making a difference. And I struggle a little bit with that now that I don't do that sort of job. And I loved the fact that it brought me into contact with so many different sorts of people in a way that I wouldn't have done if I worked in lots of other different professions. There was a kind of defining incident, I suppose, early in my police career. So I'd only been a police officer for a few weeks, and I met a woman on the streets who was the same age as me, almost sort of to the week. And we'd both gone to university. We'd both read French. And so we were talking about that, different universities, but the same sort of trajectory. And then she told me that in her second year at university, her father had died and it had hit her really hard. And her relationship with her mother had broken down and things had gone from bad to worse. She'd started taking drugs. She'd dropped out of university. And now we were, I think, 3-4 years on from that point. And I was a police officer and she was a heroin addict living on the street and shoplifting every day to support her habit. And the only difference between us was that she had been through a traumatic incident and I hadn't. And what it did was, I think I was always a compassionate person, but it really defined for me my values in life. The fact that we could all end up in a terrible situation, that so much of what happens to us is a twist of fate, is circumstance, is the opportunity that we've been born into. Life is so fragile. And so what it did was shape the way I spoke to people as a police officer, that I didn't give anyone more or less respect based on where they'd come from or how much money they had, or I treated everybody with compassion and respect and a sort of unspoken acknowledgement that I could be in their situation. And now that I've left the police, I think that's something that I still think about when I'm writing, and a lot of my books really look at that sort of grey area between a good life and a difficult life, and what makes us cross that line, what makes bad people do good things and good people do bad things. I really enjoy exploring that murky middle in my fiction.
In your books, am I right in thinking that there are more Welsh words in each book as you go along? Are you sort of learning the language and immersing yourself in it?
That's funny you should say that, because I think there's maybe less Welsh, but now I don't honestly know. Maybe you're right. Maybe I don't sort of notice it as much because I've used it more naturally. I'm not sure. So there aren't huge amounts of Welsh in these books, but when I started writing, so I am an English person who lives in Wales and I live specifically in a very Welsh speaking area. My children are bilingual. The schools here are Welsh medium. And so the language is very, very important. But before I moved here, I'm ashamed to admit that I didn't really know that Welsh was so widely spoken. I knew that Welsh was a living language, but I didn't realise that being first language Welsh doesn't just mean, oh, I can speak fluent Welsh. It's the fact that Welsh is used every day. That is the language you hear in shops. That is the language that people are speaking around the dinner table. And I think that I'm not the only English person to have that level of ignorance when it comes to the languages in the United Kingdom. And so I really wanted to just showcase the language a little bit, I suppose, and to make it much more authentic, because Fionn would be speaking Welsh and the people around her would be. And so I chose to do that by putting small bits of Welsh in the books, always bits that don't carry any sort of significance to the plot. You can gloss over them. You know, you don't have to think about it at all. In every case, it will be obvious from the context what those words mean. And so for anyone who is interested in language or in Welsh culture and history, it gives you a little insight into the language. But it's really just to remind people, I suppose, that this is a really important language for many, many people. And one of the things that I feel very proud of is when I see the translated copies of my Fionn and Leo books in different countries and see that those books are taking Welsh into Scandinavia, across Europe, to India, to, you know, all over the world. And that feels like a really important thing to have done. I'm very proud of that.
Fionn's words are, of course, spoken by Chloe Angharad Davies. Was it hard to find a narrator with that specific accent?
Really hard, yes. I was sent a lot of voice clips, and the vast majority were from actors with a South Wales accent who were doing a North Wales accent. And I, you know, in some instances, I could hear that. In others, I wasn't so sure. And so I actually had a couple of local friends listen to the clips with me and help me work out who was going to give the most authentic experience. And Chloe Angharad does such a brilliant job, and I'm really glad she's been able to take on the series. And I know from speaking to people who have listened to the books that they've really enjoyed the experience.
In this book, she's joined by Jo Eyre and Penelope Rollins. Why are the three narrators in this one?
Because it's a slightly more complex case. We've got this cold case, and there are elements of the story that we have to hide, you know, twists and reveals that I can get away with in the written word. But as soon as you start listening, you might be able to pick up some nuances that you wouldn't if you were reading. So, for example, I'm not going to talk specifically about this book because I don't want to give any spoilers. But if you have a book where you're trying to hide the identity, an unspoken narrator, so you've got a character talking directly to the reader, you might not want that reader to know if they're male or female or if they have an accent or not. And so one of the ways you can do that in an audiobook is to use a sort of a neutral narrator who's coming in without the sort of the baggage of those other characters, so they can present the narration and not give any clues away.
Yeah, yes. That's a bit of a production nightmare.
It is. And do you know what? I'm very, very mindful of it now, because in my debut novel, I Let You Go, so it was my first experience of audiobook production, and I was sent the finished book to listen to, and I started listening, and in the very first chapter there was a particular line which gave away the entire twist of the book. So I Let You Go has a sort of now kind of infamous twist that lots of readers talk about, and in the written book that line would make no influence on the twist at all, but in the audiobook it completely destroyed it. And I remember sitting there listening to this first chapter, you know, 2-3 minutes in, and thinking, oh my goodness, that's the entire book ruined, and emailing my editor in a big panic, sort of, you know, worrying that we wouldn't be able to fix this and wouldn't be able to have an audiobook. And actually it was very simple in the end, a post-production edit. We just got rid of that line. We just got rid of it completely, no re-recording. And so if you're listening to the audiobook of I Let You Go, it is minus one line from the printed version.
Detective Inspector Ray Stevens stood next to the window and contemplated his office chair, on which an arm had been broken for at least a year. Until now, he had simply taken the pragmatic approach of not leaning on the left side, but while he was at lunch, someone had scrawled defective in black marker pen across the back of it. Ray wondered if Business Support's newfound enthusiasm for equipment audits would extend to a replacement, or whether he was destined to run Bristol CID from a chair that cast serious doubts over his credibility. Leaning forward to find a marker pen in his chaotic top drawer, Ray crouched down and changed the label to Detective. The door to his office opened, and he hastily stood up, replacing the lid on the pen. Ah, Kate, I was just... He stopped, recognising the look on her face almost before he saw the command and control printout in her hand. What have you got?
That's a clip of I Let You Go, narrated by our old friend David Thorpe and Julia Barry. Now, you've narrated a book yourself, your non-fiction book, I promise it won't always hurt like this, 18 Assurances on Grief. That must have been quite a difficult read.
It was, yes. I had to audition for it, first of all, which was an odd process to audition for the role of yourself. But I'm delighted to say they gave me the part of me. And I was quite apprehensive about it because it's a very personal book. It's a book about my recovery through grief following the death of my son 18 years ago. And I knew that there would be sections of that book that I would really struggle to read. And those of you who have listened to the book will probably hear some of those. You'll hear the emotion in my voice because it's not something I could hide. And also I discovered it wasn't something I wanted to hide, because actually this book is written as a conversation between me and the reader. And so the whole premise of the book is I am going to be completely honest with you about what grief did to me, how it felt then and how it feels now and how it might feel for you. And part of that honesty is sharing that emotion, I think. But it was at times a hard thing to do. I spoke to the producer right at the start and said, look, there are going to be a couple of occasions where I might start crying, and this is how I need you to behave when that happens. I need you not to be nice to me. And he's a really nice guy. I've worked with him before. I really like him. I really admire his work. I said, I need you not to be nice to me. Do not ask if I'm okay. Don't offer me tissues. Please just ignore it. Let me center myself and then we'll carry on. And he looked so anxious about this because he's the sort of guy that absolutely would make sure that a crying person, especially a crying woman, was okay. But he very reluctantly agreed to completely ignore any distress I might be in, which he did, and it was fine. I just knew that if he was too nice, it would undo me and then I wouldn't be able to continue.
Now, all of your books over the past 10 years are all available in audio, and many are available in Braille from RNIB Talking Books. Is that important to you, that they're accessible to everyone?
I would really not want to produce a book that wasn't available in audio, absolutely. I mean, I'm thrilled that some are also available in Braille. And I'm a huge audio listener myself. The accessibility is so important, you know, to be able to borrow these books from libraries as well as buy them, to be able to read, listen, enjoy, consume in whatever way makes it easier, makes it more comfortable for my readers is an absolute priority. Yeah, absolutely.
I liked that that was part of your rules on your Facebook book club, that you can't post an image without audio description.
Yeah, I try really hard myself as well on my social media channels to add description to everything. I don't always remember, and I'm always grateful if someone gently reminds me and I'll add it. It's, you know, it's trying. I think that's the main thing. But certainly the members of my book club are getting better and better at describing the book covers that they post when they're posting reviews. And I'm really glad about that.
Talking of the book covers, we will miss that if we download the audiobook from RNIB. Can you give us a quick audio description of the cover of Other People's Houses?
I can. So what we have is a beautiful image of a swimming pool surrounded by quite a dense green hedge. The title, Other People's Houses, is in white font on the water of the swimming pool. Behind that, we've got a couple of loungers and some trees. And then the top half of the cover is sky, but the sky is in a vivid yellow, like something quite sinister is happening. We've got some clouds and some birds. My name, Claire McIntosh, a number one Sunday Times bestseller. And the tagline of the book is, you want what they have, but what price would you pay?
What do you mean he let it go? 5 minutes ago, Detective Constable Fionn Morgan had been in the perfect state between sleep and wakefulness, with every intention of having another snooze once she'd let Dave out for a wee. The call from her boss has ruined her lie-in, not least because Dave has lately begun taking Fionn's ringtone as a cue to bark furiously. He jumps on the bed, one heavy foot on Fionn's stomach, and yowls at the phone.
Just that, Detective Inspector Malik says. By the time the lad had finished puking his guts up, the kayak was sailing merrily on its way.
Will you shut up?
I beg your pardon?
Sorry, boss, I was talking to the dog. Fionn swings her legs out of bed and grabs Dave's collar, marching him out of the bedroom and shutting the door. Cardboard boxes form teetering pillars on either side of it, labels identifying the contents as clothes, books or miscellaneous. Are you telling me we have an AWOL cops in a kayak?
Claire McIntosh, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
And we'll have some book recommendations from Claire in Books of Your Life after this.
I've been involved in the Talking Book Service for a long time, since I was just starting out as an actor.
Julian Fellows on supporting Talking Books.
I suppose what draws me to it is that my whole life has been based around the word, you know, as an actor and then a screenwriter and a novelist and everything else, and the thought of being deprived of the word is terrifying to me. But also what is really crucial to the Talking Book Service is it makes blind people autonomous. You want to get back some of the pleasures that you knew before, and the one that can come back 100% unqualified is reading a book, and that is because of the Talking Book Service.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show with Robert Kirkwood.
Was there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading?
Just William books made me fall in love with reading, and I still have the entire series of them. I actually discovered them on audio. They were audio cassette at the time, and they were narrated by Martin Jarvis, and we used to listen to them in the car. And then I started buying the print editions, and now I have all 31 of them.
William Brown stood in the old barn, brandishing a bread knife. Henry, one of his boon companions, sat on an upturned packing case. Douglas, another boon companion, sat on the floor. Ginger, the fourth of the quartet, known collectively as the Outlaws, had not yet arrived. "Well, then, this man called Arthur," said William, "found the sword called He pursued an elusive word through his memory, lost track of it, and brought out, somewhat uncertainly, Excelsior. Well, he found this sword called Excelsior stuck in a solid rock. Like this."
That's Martin Jarvis reading from Just William's Luck by Richmal Crompton, one of many Just William books in the RNIB library. And is there a book on a rainy day you could happily curl up with and reread?
Yes, I recently listened to You Are Here by David Nicholls. Quite a recent book. I mean, there are lots of comfort books I could reread, but there was something so comforting about these two people taking this journey, both physically and metaphorically together. And I found it incredibly comforting. And I think I'll go back to that one.
In all her youthful visions of the future, of the job she might have, the city and home she might live in, the friends and family around her, Marnie had never thought that she'd be lonely. In her adolescence, she'd pictured the future as a series of imaginary photographs, densely populated, her friends' arms draped around each other, eyes red from the flash of the camera in the taverna or lit by the flames of a driftwood fire on the beach. And there, right in the centre, her own smiling face. The later photos were harder to pin down, the faces less defined, but perhaps there'd be a partner, even children among the friends she would surely know and love all her life. but she hadn't taken a photograph of another person for 6 years. The last time she'd had her picture taken was at passport control, where she'd been instructed not to smile. Where had everyone gone?
You Are Here by David Nicholls is available from RNIB Library as narrated by Lee Ingleby and Lydia Leonard. And is there a book you've read recently? It doesn't have to be a contemporary book, but something you've read recently, it's fresh in the mind, you'd like to recommend.
Yes, I listened to Famous Last Words by Gillian McAllister, which is very recently out. It's really fast-paced, really twisty, really clever. Thoroughly recommend. It's beautifully narrated.
It is 1 hour before Camilla's life changes, though she doesn't yet know it. All she knows right now, as she cleans the high chair while Polly sits on her playmat after breakfast, is that her husband isn't here. He's gone somewhere, left her to deal with Polly's first day of nursery and Camilla's return to work by herself. Has he got a deadline? Has she forgotten some urgent project? But Cam doesn't forget things. Luke actually forgets things, so... Sunlight enters stage left in her kitchen in three distinct shafts. It's a perfect June day, and Cam woke up a mixed bag of emotions. Nervous, but excited. Sad. Happy. Her first day back at work after a long 9-month maternity leave. She sometimes longs for words in the English language that don't exist, and today is one such occasion. Trepidation, excitement. When she woke up, she thought, nope, none of them cut it. And Luke has chosen today to disappear.
Famous Last Words by Gillian McAllister is available in the RNIB Talking Books Library as read by Amelia Fox. And once again, Claire McIntosh, thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure.
That's all we've got time for on today's show. We'll be back at the same time next week. But if you can't wait that long, this and over 400 other episodes of Read On are available to download as a podcast. Just search for RNIB Read On in your favourite podcast app. But remember our daily show, Talking Books, featuring the best the RNIB Library has to offer, that we're allowed to play on here. That's every day at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. if you prefer a book at bedtime. The whole schedule is at rnib.org.uk/connect-radio.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.